I want to take this opportunity to thank Father LaRue for inviting me. It's a great joy for me to come here. I don't travel as much as I used to, and I'm turning things down, but it's always good to come to my second home, and thank you, Father, for inviting me, and I certainly hope to come back again. God willing, and if the crick don't rise, as we say over in Wisconsin. So, there's the correct spelling of Katherna. I spelled it wrong on the board. I realized when I had finished the last talk. Two other little things. One, I have some pictures here. Do take a look at them before you go. From a production done at the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis in 1967. It was one of the last things that Dr. Guthrie, the great director and for whom the theater is named, did before his death. And it was staggering. I was lucky. I got to see it more than once. But you'll get a sense of the immensity of it, and they look like moving statues. It is ritualistic. It was a stunning, dramatic experience. I was lucky to see it. One other little thing. The Apocalypse is being read at meals. And something occurred to me. This is my own peculiar theory. This has nothing to do with anything. So discount it before I say it. I was railing this afternoon about electricity and electronics and computers and all the little devices. It's the last verse of the Apocalypse chapter 12. The dragon is in a battle with the woman. And he hates the woman. We know who that is, okay? And we know who the dragon is. But the last verse is, and he stood upon the sand of the sea. And it has become clear to me since Sister Lucy told us that that is one of the chapters that applies to our time. It's silicon. Without which, silicon made from sand, all those little chips, without which we'd have none of that junk, which is indeed the domain of the powers of darkness. White's crackpot theory, thank you. I'm no theologian or Bible historian, discount the whole thing. White's crackpot theory. Now, I'm going to try to get through two plays in this last talk. I've tried to set things up. I hope I can do it. We'll see what I accomplish. Again, we're heading to the Libation Bearers, the second part of the trilogy. And again, let me just remind you of the way into most Greek tragedies. What do? You ask yourself, number one, what's the title? Why is the title there? What does it refer to? Number two, where is the setting? And I already mentioned that we're indeed, again, in front of the house of Atreus. We're there where the first play took place, but now the altar is significant. The altar was a permanent part of that setting, but it isn't used really in the first play. But here it becomes important, and it is connected with the tomb of Agamemnon, and Agamemnon's tomb becomes central. So that's important. You look and see who makes up the chorus. This is a play named for the chorus. In the Greek, it's koephori, pardon my Greek. It means the libation bearers. The second play is named for the chorus. Those who carry the libations to Agamemnon's grave. And that chorus is made up of slave women that have been brought back from Troy. They lost the war. The women are enslaved. They've been taken to Argos. They are now slaves in the house of Atreus. But interestingly enough, joining them is Electra, the sister of Orestes, the sister of Iphigenia, who was killed. But she's part of that chorus. She enters with the chorus. Why the libation bearers? Why is the play called the libation bearers? Well, it connects with that fact of the tomb that's in the front. This play, again, is about the power of the past, but now it becomes even more specific in that there is something owed to the dead. When the dead have left this life, according to the Greeks, they did go to Hades, a mysterious place, not quite what we would consider as the afterlife, but they are there as shades. They're somehow there. But the notion in this play is that those who remain living have obligations to the dead. Okay? What is the principal conflict? It's going to be Orestes between his mother and then those who come in to defend her after she dies, and that's the Furies. Okay? So, if you can get these basics, you have a way into almost any Greek tragedy. Ask yourself those basics. The play opens with Orestes coming back from exile and visiting his father's grave. He says openly he was not there when his father was murdered. Clytemnestra sent him into exile. She was planning on killing Agamemnon. She didn't want the son around. And he says, indeed, that he wasn't there. Well, I was not here to mourn you when you died, my father. Never gave the last salute when they bore your corpse away. Now he's returned to see his father. The second part of the trilogy also opens with a prayer, just as the first part, Agamemnon, began with the watchman praying to the gods that they would end his time of waiting on the roof. Hermes, Lord of the dead, look down and guard the Father's power. Be my Savior, I beg you. Be my comrade now. A prayer to the God of the dead. The dead make demands. The libation bearers come bearing libations to honor the dead and put the dead to rest. Let me say this again. The Greeks in their wisdom, Aeschylus in his inspiration, is onto something that we have forgotten. And that is that the dead must be remembered and the dead need to be honored. And there is a connection between the living and the dead. And the living have obligations to the dead. It is very interesting that when heresy sprouted, when the Protestant heresy sprouted in the time in Germany, at the time of Henry VIII, one of the things that they insisted on was there was no longer any need to pray for the dead. When they're dead, they go to judgment, it's settled, it's all over, don't bother with the dead. And one of the greatest battles, this again is in Eamon Duffy's The Stripping of the Altar, was that the people of England continued to honor and pray for the dead. But they were told, no need for it, no need, stop it, it's not allowed. The atheists don't want any prayers for the dead, much less visits. They don't believe in prayer. And number two, don't visit the graveyard. There is a magnificent short one-page piece by Alexander Solzhenitsyn called We Will Never Die, in which he takes to task the Soviet regime, who is discouraging Soviet citizens from visiting graveyards and the graves of those they loved. It was a foolish activity. It was a waste of time. They could be out there building tractors or promoting the Communist Manifesto. Waste of time to visit the dead. And we know now what's happening. It's epidemic now. The notion that when you're dead, therefore burn up my body and take it to my favorite football field and scatter my ashes on the 50-yard line. Okay? It's everywhere. Grandpa just loved being at this one park, so he loved taking the dog for the walk, so we're going to take Grandpa's ashes and just scatter them at the dog park. And it's as if, okay, that's now on with our lives. The Greeks understood there are bonds, there are connections. The dead must be honored. And it's everywhere in this play. It's central to this play, okay? Perhaps, and Orestes is there, he cuts a lock of his hair, he puts it on his father's grave, it's a tribute, and he sees the libation bearers coming, the women mourning and carrying the libations to pour on the grave. Perhaps they come to honor you, my father, bearing cups to soothe and still the dead. We find out what they're doing is Clytemnestra can't sleep, she's troubled, she's worried, she wants to see to it that Agamemnon's soul is finally gone and quieted. Electra's coming to honor her father. The slave women are ordered to do it. He was the one who destroyed their city, but they are there being obedient and pouring libations on his grave, and now Orestes is there. And what happens? This is the next generation we're dealing with now. Iphigenia has been killed by her father. Electra has been thrown out of the house and is basically living in the doghouse out back with the servant women. Orestes has returned from exile. His mother doesn't know he's there. And the play begins with this extended scene where brother and sister come to recognize each other. She doesn't know her own brother. And she sees the lock of the hair. Whose could it be? She sees a footstep in the dust surrounding the tomb. Who could it be? It is a magnificent moment of drama where the sister comes to realize, and Orestes finally admits, brother and sister. But what we have is the shattering of the family. If this curse continues, there will be nothing left. This will continue throughout this play. As Orestes presents himself to his own mother as a stranger, and she doesn't recognize him. He comes to the house as a guest, claiming to have information, and gives the false news that her son Orestes is dead. And she feigns sorrow and is filled with joy because she's been worried he would come back. Why? To avenge his father. The sister doesn't recognize the brother. The mother doesn't recognize the son. The recognition scenes in this play, she does when he pulls the sword. That's how the mother recognizes the son. It's terrifying. It's horrifying again. The blood is flowing from generation to generation. And it is now landed here. The women come again to pour the libations, to offer prayers at the tomb. Orestes begins the play with a prayer. Look down and guard the father's power. And indeed, those who do honor to the dead in this play are indeed guarded. They will make it to the end. Electra offers up a prayer. Oh, bring Orestes home, she prays as she pours the libations. Little suspecting, that prayer is already answered. He's hiding right near the tomb and will soon reveal himself. Orestes again offers up a prayer later in the play. He must have revenge on his mother. I pray to the earth and my father's grave to bring that dream to life in me. Let me revenge my father's murder. It will happen. He will do that. The old nurse comes in. It's a wonderful little comic moment. You'll watch it later. It's lovely. Orestes' old wet nurse. And it's heartbreaking because she shows the mother love that his mother can't show him. She nursed him. She raised the baby. Word has come that he is dead, and she is heartbroken. She is absolutely heartbroken, and she talks to the chorus, and they know Orestes is back, but they can't say anything. They don't dare let her know. And they say to her, you're glad, she says, you're glad this news has come? If Zeus will turn the evil wind to good, they say, trust in God. God will bring things to good. But how, Orestes, the hope of the house is gone. Not yet. It's a poor seer who'd say so. What are you saying? Something I don't know? Go in with your message. Do as you're told. May the gods take care of cares that come from them. Trust in the gods. They'll take care of things. They do. Well, I'm off. I'll do as I told. And here's to the best. Some help, dear gods. Some help. And they send help. But not until later. But not until later. The point I'm making here, in fact, the play ends. I'm going to the very end of the play. The leader of the chorus, as Orestes, driven mad, having seen the Furies, and they're now pursuing him, and he rushes maddened off the stage, God look down on you with kindness, guard you, grant you fortune, and in the next play, the gods will. Every prayer is answered. And we have here a notion of the efficacy of prayer, the link between the human and the divine. And the absolute need for prayer and the fact that the gods are listening, but will not necessarily answer in our time, but in the gods' own good time. It's an astonishing thing. And there it is. And again, the Greeks came onto it by seeking truth, not through divine revelation. It's quite remarkable. Now, the curse has descended, has gone down to the next generation, as I said. What we learn after Orestes identifies himself to his sister and makes clear that he has come now indeed to avenge his father. We learn that he is doing it because Apollo told him to. We have a whole new level that enters this play. In the past, the blood curse has gone from generation to generation out of revenge, getting back at what was done because there is no such thing as forgiveness in this family line. What happens must be avenged, revenged. And that is what has driven the action. Orestes has come back. It's obvious that he knows his father was murdered. He knows his mother did it. He knows Aegisthus is living in the house with her, that there is adultery in the house. He says he's come to revenge his father, but then we discover he's not just doing it on his own. Apollo, the god of the sun, has ordered him to do it. What the play presents as a puzzle is, wait a minute, how have the gods gotten involved in this now? And why is it that the god Apollo, the sun god, is now ordering the youngest member of the house of Atreus to exact revenge? And indeed, we have the additional complexity. Clytemnestra murdered her husband. It was an oath. It was a bond. They were married. But what Orestes is being ordered to do is to kill his mother, the source of his life. She who nurtured him in the womb. And it is deeply disturbing. There is something so primal in the link between child and mother that he is aware of the horrible possibilities. He goes into the house first and kills Aegisthus. Takes care of that problem. And comes out with the body of Aegisthus, with his friend Orestes' friend Pylades, who has traveled with him, standing by the body. Clytemnestra weeps for her dead lover. Orestes, you love your man? Then lie in the same grave. You can never be unfaithful to the dead. Oh, you're going to shed tears? You're going to shed water on your dead adulterous lover? You who killed my father in cold blood? Wait, my son, no respect for this, my child. The breast you had held, drowsing away the hours, soft gums tugging the milk that made you grow. It's too much for him. He turns to his friend. What will I do, Pylades? I dread to kill my mother. It's a human reaction. We're at the crux of the drama again. We're at the center of the drama. This is the only speech his friend Pylades has in the whole play. What of the future? Now, Apollo was also the god of prophecy. Not just the god of the sun, but the god of prophecy. And what Pylades invokes now is, think ahead. This is not looking back to the past, this is looking forward. What of the future? What of the prophet god Apollo, the Delphic voice, the faith, and oaths we swear? Make all mankind your enemy, not the gods. And we learn that Orestes has sworn an oath to Apollo to take his mother's life. It's mysterious. We cannot understand it at this time. But please notice, the turning point in the action is the best friend by his side reminding him, you must honor the oath you made to God first. Everything else will follow from that. And even if you don't know what the future may hold, honor the oath. Because Apollo must know what the future will hold, because he told you to do it, and he's the god of prophecy. We must trust that there is an end. Now let me explain something here. It's something very mysterious. The Greeks, as you well know, believed in fate. And that whole notion of fate goes all the way back. It was ingrained in them. So that you had the idea that you could not change fate. It's what Oedipus is all about. Okay? If it has been predicted, if it is fated, you can try to avoid it. You're not going to avoid it. Fate is real. At the same time, they seem to believe in choice. Orestes saying, what do I do? What do I do? Do I kill her or don't I kill her? This choice is before him. And the notion that Apollo has somehow seen something good will come out of it, so you must make your choice that way. It's puzzling. Think of it this way. For the Greeks, there were the simple human beings who were human. Humanity referencing humanity, and that's the mass of men. Then there were the great heroes. Then there were the great heroes. Those who were human, but touched with divinity, rising above their station, showing something godlike in their abilities. A Hercules, half divine. These enormous heroic figures that are human, but touch the divine. Then you have the divine gods. I referenced Zeus earlier. Who are indeed gods, possessed of divinity, but touched with human weaknesses as well. Zeus has got to keep coming down to earth and getting involved with human women. Not something a god should be doing, but a very recognizable human weakness. So in the same way that you had human beings with divine attributes, you had the divine gods who had human attributes, and then you had fate hanging over all of it, who was fate older than time itself and somehow separate. What they could not conceive of, what they did not get to, was the idea of the divine being fully divine, being perfect, being entirely good, and combining with fate what we call providence, so that the indeed perfect divine divine incorporates fate for the ultimate good of everything. Because God, being total perfection, total good, being omniscient, knowing all, knows what will happen, knows fate, it all works out for the best. It will work out for the good. We get a tiny hint of it here. Just a hint, a glimmer, a flicker of that idea. What of the prophet god Apollo, the Delphic voice, the faith, and the oaths we swore? Apollo made you do it. There must be a good end. There must be a good end. And indeed, after a terrible, terrible back and forth debate with the mother, he drags her back into the house. We don't get the murder on stage. He drags her into the house. And the chorus gathers at the altar, saying justice has finally come to the house. It's tough. It's hard. It's ugly. But they keep saying, Apollo wills it so. Apollo wills it so. Apollo, clear from earth's deep cleft, his voice came shrill. Now stealth will master stealth. And the pure God came down and healed our ancient wounds. The chorus thinks it's finally over. It's settled. Apollo commanded it. This terrible blood chain is finished. Orestes comes out of the house. Now the body of Clytemnestra, his mother, has joined the body of Aegisthus. Behold the double tyranny of our land. They're entangled in robes, as his father was tangled in the net. And he kneels by the body of his mother, aware of what he's done, And the chorus says, you did what you had to do. The God demanded it. And he says, I see no end in sight. It's not over. I am a charioteer. The reins are flying. Look, the mares plunge off the track. And we're back at the beginning of the story. We're back at the beginning of the story with that chariot race, okay? And the chariot plunging away. It's a clear reference back to that. My bolting heart, it beats me down, and terror beats the drum. My dance and singing master pitched to fury. And still, while I still have some self-control, I say to my friends in public, I killed my mother, not with a little justice. She was stained with father's murder. She was cursed by God, and the magic spells that fired up my daring. One comes first, the seer of Delphi who declared, go through with this, and you go free of guilt. Fail and something awful. He breaks off there. If you don't do this, if you don't do this, something awful will happen. If you do it, you go free of guilt. And suddenly, he sees the Furies. How can this be? How can this be? Can't have it both ways. And he howls. He looks beyond. Nobody else on stage can see them. No! No, women! Look! Like gorgons, shrouded in black, their heads wreathed. Swarming serpents cannot stay. I must move on. The leader of the chorus says, wait, what's wrong with you? What's going on with you? What's this? You're having a dream. No dreams, these torments, not to me. They're clear, real. The hounds of my mother's hate. Already his mother is demanding vengeance and has sent the Furies after him. The blood's still wet on your hands. It puts a kind of frenzy in you. God, Apollo! He cries out to the god who told him to do it. Here they come, thick and fast, their eyes dripping hate. One, the leader, one thing will purge you. Apollo's touch will set you free from all your torments. You can't see them! I can! They drive me on! I must move on! And he runs out in a frenzy. End of play. It's not settled. And now we've got a larger issue. Apollo orders it. He does it. If he doesn't do it, then he's in terrible trouble. He does it. There are the Furies demanding revenge for Clytemnestra. What's happened here? What's happened here is we now have, as I said earlier, the central conflict in the third part of the play, the Eumenides, is between the gods themselves. We now have the conflict moving into the heavens. Who are these gods? The Furies are the old primal goddesses. They are earth goddesses. They are goddesses of passion, goddesses of blood, goddesses of revenge, goddesses who were there from the very earliest days. They are goddesses of nature. But what they demand, what they call upon, is blood for blood. And when blood is spilled, they will demand vengeance. The fact that they have shown up here is not unusual. That's what they do. But they are the old gods. There is a new set of gods, and these are the gods that Aeschylus is defending. The new young gods, and they are the divine gods, the gods of the heavens, the gods of light, the gods of all that which is good. Now, as I said, they are all touched with human flaws. The greatest of them, Zeus, has his weaknesses. But they are divine, they are heavenly, they are beyond the earth, they are more than earthly. There has been a transformation in religion from the old religion to a new religion. And they may seem to be one, but it is a complete transformation because of the birth of new gods that have now changed the way the whole universe operates. That's a curiosity. Puzzle on it on your own later. This enormous change because of the new gods. But the old gods are not gone. They're still around, and they are threatening to destroy everything. The Eumenides, where are we? We open at the temple of Apollo at Delphi. we have Pythia, the great priestess, the one who would go into the temple and Apollo would speak through her. And people would get answers to their prayers and questions. She begins with an enormously long prayer. So the third part of the trilogy, the Eumenides, opens again with a prayer, a very long prayer. And then she does what it is her job to do. A priestess goes into the sacred space, okay? She goes into the sacred space, and we hear a scream, a howl. What we've been hearing before from inside the house of Atreus. She runs out and describes what she saw in there. And what has happened is that Orestes has taken refuge there. Apollo is guarding him, but the Furies have taken over the shrine of Apollo. They have quite literally invaded the sacred space of the new gods, have taken control, and are there to see that Orestes gets what's coming to him, and the priestess is in horror. I gotta tell you, in the original production, and we have the records of this, when the chorus appeared and it was clear that the chorus was the Furies and that this chorus of Furies had taken over the sacred shrine of Apollo, women in the audience miscarried, grown men became hysterical, children fainted and had to be carried from the theater. The idea was so horrifying to the audience that there was that sort of intense reaction, and so intense it was recorded. We know it happened. The production you will see is not that... they're rather quiet. They're rather subtle. This production I saw that Dr. Guthrie did in Minneapolis... The lights came up on the third part of the play dimly. All you could see was this mass of moving figures with grotesque... You can see the Furies in the last photo of the... They don't have eyes, they don't have mouths, they just... It sort of looks like lava pits or terrible acne that's broken open. And they had robes covered in little bits of tin. And when they rubbed against each other, it sounded like a fork inside a tin can. The noise that makes your teeth go, oh, except you had about 20 of them doing this together. The audience, I mean, he managed to give us a little sense. It was just like, ugh, yeah, this is awful. Got a little sense of it. And then when the lights became brighter, there was Apollo guarding Orestes. Orestes had gone gray. Aged like that, gone gray. Horrifying stage picture. And they were breathing heavily. Russell, scrape, scrape. It was scary stuff. It was real theater, okay? The priestess is horrified. Apollo speaks and tells Orestes he will not abandon him. And then turns on the Furies, who are half asleep, not active, and suddenly the ghost of Clytemnestra appears, and orders the Furies to wake up and get about their business, because she has a right to demand of them that they exact vengeance on her son. And indeed, they wake up, they begin speaking, they're the chorus, and they attack Apollo. Young god! You have ridden down the powers proud with age. You worship the suppliant, the godless man who tears his parents' heart, the matricide. You steal him away, and you, a god. And we have the contest between the gods. He hands it right back to them. Heave in torment, black froth erupting from your lungs. Vomit the clots of all the murders you have drained. but never touch my halls, you have no right. Go where heads are severed, eyes gouged out, where justice and bloody slaughter are the same. Castrations, wasted seed, young men's glories butchered, extremities maimed and huge stones at the chest, and the victims wail for pity, spikes inching up the spine, torsos stuck on spikes. It's epic, it's huge, it's grand. And Orestes is caught in the middle. It's the reason it's called the Oresteia. He's at the center of this conflict. In the previous play, he was the protagonist. Now he's stuck in the middle between this enormous, enormous conflict. And what happens is, the Furies demand justice. Apollo says he will defend him. And we move to the Acropolis in Athens, to the Temple of Athena. Because that's where Apollo takes Orestes, and so the Furies follow. Understand something. The theater in which the audience was seeing the play was just below the Acropolis. The play now moves to the setting right upstairs, right above, on the rock right above. I'm talking that kind of immediacy that's almost unimaginable. And indeed, we are now at the Temple of Athena, and I must say a word about Athena. Athena was one of the new gods. Athena was the guardian of the city of Athens. Athena was noted as the goddess of wisdom. And here's what's very mysterious, is that wisdom for the Greeks was female. So that the goddess who possesses wisdom is female. If you read in the book of wisdom in scripture, there are countless times when wisdom is referred to as female. And I forget which one of the feast days of Our Lady it is. Maybe someone can tell me. Where the reading of the epistle comes from the book of wisdom and Mother Church is clearly applying it to Mother Mary herself. Why should wisdom be female? We get it in scripture. The church implies it clearly in that feast day of Our Lady. And for the Greeks, wisdom was Athena. And it means that wisdom has not just to do with knowledge or thought or reason. All that is part of it. But it also demands the heart. And it is, as we know, that wisdom of the heart, the love of the heart, that women are particularly good at. So you combine the brilliance of rational thought, profound belief, the true emotions of the heart, and in these cases we get wisdom who's presented as female. Now, but here's a curiosity. Athena had an unusual, miraculous birth, unlike any other god or goddess. She sprang full-blown from the head of her father Zeus. She didn't have a mother, meaning it was an extremely unusual conception and birth. And the woman who is going to resolve this question is a woman born in a special way in unusual circumstances. I just find it fascinating. And to be quite honest, the more I've read this play, I find it deeply moving. I'm not making an exact parallel. I wouldn't dare to do so. But how on earth, again, did the Greeks come to some kind of understanding, some glimmer, that at the moment of ultimate crisis, when things cannot seem to be resolved, that it is a woman of miraculous birth who will resolve the issues and somehow make it all possible. It's just very, very strange. They go to her temple. She appears. The Furies continue their attack on Orestes. And Orestes utters a line that rings throughout these plays. The elders used it in Agamemnon. It's appeared other places. It appears everywhere. The version you're watching gives a different translation, but this is the one to remember. Orestes says, I have suffered into truth. I have suffered into truth. He now has some understanding. He's beginning to grasp what has happened to him, but it's only because he has suffered. And this will become a hallmark of many of the greatest Greek tragedies, certainly in Oedipus, certainly in many of the other plays. Here it appears for the first time. The way to come to truth, the way to understand truth, the way to gain truth, you have to suffer. You have to suffer. I have suffered into truth. Well, I know the countless arts of purging, where to speak, where silence is the rule. In this ordeal, a compelling master urges me to speak. It's Apollo. The blood sleeps. It is fading on my hands. The stain of mother's murder washing clean. It was still fresh at the god's hearth. That is, when he was at Delphi. Apollo killed the swine, and the purges drove it off. This is made clearer for us shortly thereafter when Orestes explains to Athena that he has been purged of his guilt. The law condemns the man of the violent hand to silence till a master trained at purging slits the throat of a young suckling victim. Blood absolves his blood. The only way to be clear of the blood, the only way to free oneself from blood, is sacrificial blood. Now here, it's a pig. It's the offering of an animal sacrifice. Long ago, in the halls of others, I was fully cleansed in the cleansing springs, the blood of many victims. Thread of pollution, sweep it from your mind. He's saying to Athena, I will not soil your temple. Apollo cleansed me. And the cleansing took place by blood, sacrificial blood. She says, all right, then I understand, and we're welcome. Now let's hear the arguments. A suppliant cleansed, you bring my house no harm, she says. But she turns to the Furies and says, but they have their destiny too, hard to dismiss. And if they fail to win their day in court, how it will spread, the venom of their pride, plague, everlasting blights our land, our future. So it stands, a crisis either way. She is a young god like Apollo. She understands that Orestes has been clean, but she will not just dismiss the Furies. They have to be dealt with. You can't just ignore the old goddesses. And they have a case to make. And notice what she says. It's fascinating. What has to happen here, they must have their day in court. And what is happening now is Athena, in her wisdom, says there is only one way to deal with this, justice, in a court of law. And says, I will now establish a court that will hear this case. And I will establish it in Athens from this time forward so that these bitter contests that seem insoluble can be settled clearly, rationally, fairly, once and for all. There must be justice. If you remember when Agamemnon returned, he said his hope was to establish a kind of tribunal so that there in that city there would be a perpetual kind of justice. It doesn't happen in Argos. It happens in Athens. It happens in Athens. And she establishes the Areopagus and goes on at length to explain what this will be. Here from the heights, terror and reverence, my people's kindred powers will hold them from injustice through the day and through the mild night. Here's what has to be done to keep that justice correct and to keep the court pure. Never pollute our law with innovations. Justice cannot endure if you're changing things. It will no longer be just. And if you start changing things with innovations within the laws, within the established traditional rules, you will pollute. Know, my citizens, foul a clear well, and you will suffer thirst. It's a wonderful image. She's establishing the clear well of justice. You start changing things, you'll foul the waters of the well, pollute them, and you will no longer be able to drink from them. Neither anarchy nor tyranny, my people, worship the mean, the middle ground. I urge you, shore it up with reverence, and never banish terror from the gates, not outright. Where is the righteous man who knows no fear? Fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The goddess of wisdom says fear. If you're going to be righteous, fear. If you're going to sit in judgment on others in a court, fear. What we are seeing established, and it's the reason I call this play, a record of the coming of the dawn of Western civilization, is a court is being established. An earthly court here set up to decide a divine contest. But what it promises is a good future where justice will put an end to blood revenge. And in fairness, it will be possible for civilized men and women to decide arguments fairly and the community to continue going forward. The stronger your fear, your reverence for the just, the stronger your country's wall and city safety, stronger by far than all men else possess. We get the play, it turns into a courtroom drama. And the play ends at the Areopagus. We shift there again, right near the Acropolis, where indeed the cases in Athens were decided. And what happens is the case is argued between Apollo and the Furies. Both cases are presented. And then the citizens of Athens, those who are chosen to be on the panel, must cast their vote. But something very curious happens. Before the vote is taken, Athena, having listened to both sides, says to Orestes, I will cast my lot for you, if it's a tie. No mother gave me birth. I honor the male in all things but marriage. Yes, with all my heart, I am my father's child. I cannot set more store by the woman's death. She killed her husband, guardian of their house. If the vote is equal, Orestes wins. The god declares in advance how it will come out if there's a tie. So the vote is taken, and of course what happens? It's a tie. Because we have an equally balanced argument in case. And at that point, Athena says, well, I told you, I decide for Orestes. And the Furies are simply furious, simply furious, and begin cursing everyone. you younger gods, you have written down the ancient laws, wrenched them from my grasp, and I, robbed of my birthright, suffering great with wrath, I loose my poison over the soil. Poison to match my grief comes pouring out my heart, cursing the land to burn it sterile, and now rising up from its roots, a cancer-blasting leaf and child, now for justice. Justice. And Athena calms them down. Wait a minute. It's not over yet. And what she says to them is, you do have a claim. You were the old goddesses. You do have a role to perform because you are goddesses of the earth and must be honored. But her proposition is this. You will be honored from this day forward in Athens, but that passion, that life force that drives all living things must be transformed away from revenge. The blood driving blood chain in the house to being the source of domestic happiness. And where will the passion be located and therefore be honored? You goddesses will be honored in the passion of the marriage bed between husband and wife and in the passion of childbirth. There will be pain. There will be suffering. There will be passion. But it will be of the bond of marriage and new life and new birth. And everyone in Athens must honor you in that case. And instead of being the Furies, I now deem you, it's the title of the play, the Eumenides, the peaceful ones. Because they will give blessing to every home, and then that blessing will spread out in fertility across the fields, and the plants will grow, and they will again be earth goddesses, but now nurtured with love and peace and joy and happiness and not blood. It's magnificent. The leader of the chorus. Your magic is working. I can feel the hate, the fury, slipping away. At last, Athena says. Now take root in the land and win yourself new friends. A spell, what spell to sing to bind the land forever? Tell us. And Athena has this wonderful speech about blessing and the future seed of Athens. And the Furies embrace one home, Athena, and that's the same. Notice what's happening. The blessing is coming on the city of Athens. Where are we watching the play? In Athens. Where is this all taking place? Right, just right up the hill from here. You know, it's right, this all went on right up there. What Aeschylus is doing is explaining something to his own citizens. The immensity of the gift they've been given in the city of Athens, the glory of Athens, the coming of the court, the coming of justice. You're civilized now. You must behave that way. You must behave that way. And Athena, again, calls for the blessings. There's a giant final chorus. They're all very happy. And the women of the city join the Furies, now the Eumenides, the peaceful one. Torches are lighted, beautiful robes are put on the Eumenides, the peaceful ones, because we will now march in joy throughout the city of Athens, singing, bless the land with kindly hearts, you awesome spirits, come exult in the blazing torch, exultant in the fires, journey on, cry, cry in triumph. Carry on the dancing, on and on. This peace between Athena's people and their guests must never end. All seeing Zeus and fate embrace, the new gods and the old gods are one now. The conflict is resolved. Down they come to urge our union on. Cry, cry in triumph, carry on the dancing, and dance on and on. And the procession heads out of the theater into the streets of Athens, and the audience joins them. Stunning, staggering, a beautiful play, filled with astonishing insights, hints of a greater truth that came to us through Revelation, the coming of justice, the coming of civilization, the settling of the old order, the transformation of the Furies into the Eumenides. I say with sorrow, we've now reverted. We've reverted. Justice is polluted. Everything, all tradition is filled with innovation. The gods are not honored. There is no sense of the sacred. There is no sense of piety. If there is piety, it gets turned inward, like Agamemnon's, praising the gods so he can show off. Horrible, horrible. And the angry female goddesses are unleashed. Without wisdom and just calling for blood and revenge and shattering everything, someone should write an anti-Oresteia. It's heartbreaking. But what we know for certain because we've been told, and what Aeschylus intuited and presents in the play, is that for us, God in his providence, and in the play, for Apollo and the young gods with their vision, the future will work out. The future will work out. We have more certainty than they did. And Athens did fall. In worldly terms, the city of man is in terrible trouble. But we know from St. Augustine, we have no abiding city here on earth. But thanks be to God, we've been given a vision of the heavenly city that will not fail, that will always be there, that calls us upward. But it must begin with an understanding of the riches and blessings we've been given, holding true to them, seeing to it that we engage in justice, because justice precedes mercy. There can be no mercy without justice. And the world right now is screaming out for God's justice. You have a very serious task ahead of you. To be training to be young priests at this time, there's nothing more important you could be doing. But it is an enormous task, a great burden, and make yourselves worthy of it, trusting in God. And knowing that, in God's providence, it will all work for the good. And if you stay true to the faith, we hope to one day, be together in that eternal city. Thank you very much. Take a couple of questions, if there are a couple of questions. Yes?
Why doesn't Orestes or Electra, why doesn't it, don't they have any hatred towards their father for the sacrifice of their other sister?
Probably because when it happens, they are much, much younger. Just in terms of age, they probably didn't know much about it. But also the other thing is, they honor their father. This was a patriarchy. And even if they don't understand it, they would honor their father.
Was it because maybe they realized that the gods had ordered it?
It's interesting. It really isn't until Apollo intervenes with Orestes we have a sense of the gods ordering it. Before then, it is it's just blood revenge being passed. It's the curse being passed down. It's a fair question, but again, one has to be a little careful in looking for personal motivation in a kind of psychological way that we're used to doing because of the time we live in and later dramas we've seen. Again, much of this is ritualistic. So certain questions don't get addressed. And that's a fair one that he doesn't really deal with in the play. Yes, yes. You're all very quiet. Yes, yes indeed.
What's Apollo's intent for initially intervening?
Because he is seeing the better end for the human race, for the city of Athens, and now is the time, it is, if I may put it this way, he sees the time coming to end the blood, the spilling of the blood, and to do away with the old ways. Something new has to take its place. Has to be civilized, has to be just, and therefore he has to intervene. Now, being the god of prophecy, he sees all the way to the end that's what's going to happen. He knows what's going to happen. But, of course, the Furies don't. They don't have that gift of prophecy. They feel rejected, cast out, and no longer honored. And that's all they've known. They are who they are until they're transformed at the very end. Yes?
I read once that if someone's good at writing a tragedy, they should also be good at writing a comedy.
Thank you. Good question. Yes, the Greeks believed if you could write tragedies, you also should write good comedies. Every trilogy ended with what was called a satyr play. The satyr being that goat-like creature. Again, we're back to the goat. But a naughty goat creature, okay? The Satyr play was a comic afterpiece. You would write your trilogy, your three tragedies, and then you also had to write a comic afterpiece, okay? We know there was one connected with this. It was called the Proteus, and it apparently had to do with Agamemnon sailing the sea, trying to get back, and Proteus, the changeable god who could take any form, but we've lost it. We lost all of the Satyr plays. But every one of the tragedians had to provide a one-act comic afterpiece dealing somehow with the same material in a comic way, if you will, to somehow transform, to leave people in a better mood when they left. Now, this play has a happy ending. I have no doubt what happened is we had a long procession through the streets of Athens. Then they came back to the theater and had a good laugh. We have a fragment of one Satyr play by Euripides, just a fragment of it. So it's hard to say even what it was. But the Satyr plays became so popular, they then established a comic competition as well. Three playwrights chosen, each one would write a single comedy to be presented on a day following the tragic competition, and one of those would be awarded. And from those comic writers, we get the great, great, very naughty, very funny Aristophanes. At some point I should talk about Aristophanes. I love him. I've done a couple of his plays. I did one at the Naval Academy. Got in horrific trouble. I did his play, The Birds. It's all contemporary humor, and I took every Athens and Greece joke and turned it into a Naval Academy joke. And After we did decent business opening night, the next night I sold $1,000 worth of tickets at the door. The midshipmen lined up across the campus to get in because word was out that I mocked a professor of electrical engineering that the mids hated. There's a song in the play where the bird chorus sings about one of the politicians in the city that nobody could stand. And they come out and just sing this vicious song about him. Well, I did it about an electrical engineering. He flunked everybody. You couldn't pass his course. There was no point in trying. All the mids flunked his course. And I figured he deserved a little comic justice. And it was a very funny song I wrote. The mids were just cheering. I made a joke about the football coach, and he was losing at the time. It was a very funny. I referred to a recent game. The biggest one in the middle of the original play, the bird chorus comes down and says to the judges, "If you award our play first prize, we'll do wonderful things for you. We'll feather your nest. When you're walking down the streets of Athens, we'll drop berries and nuts in your mouth. We'll do wonderful things. So give us first prize." Well, what I did, I had the same moment the bird chorus came down and said, why, it was a time of a big scandal in the nuclear navy, bribery, okay? Bribery scandal. They came down and said, if there are critics here tonight, you're all critics. If you say wonderful things about us, give us a good write-up, call your friends, tell them what wonderful play this is. We'll feather your nest. We'll do wonderful things for you. As you walk down the streets of Annapolis, we'll drop berries and nuts in your mouth. In fact, we'll shower you with more gifts than General Dynamics gave to Admiral Rickover. And there was this. Monday morning, I was ordered to the commandant's office to bring a copy of the script in which I circled all the offensive parts. I said, well, we lost the script about 3 weeks ago. I mean, much of it was improvised as we went. And I said, plus, I don't know what's offensive, what's not. They were furious. There were calls coming from the city of Annapolis. We all went to the superintendent's office. He was Athena, and the commandant, you know, was the Furies, and I was the innocent Orestes. Well, the superintendent said, well, I don't know what's going on. He said, well, the only thing I can do is I'll let it continue. I'll go to the next performance, and then I'll decide whether it can keep running. So he showed up the next week, laughed all the way through it. He was a good guy. He said, it's uproariously funny. If they can't take a joke, too bad for them, and we got to keep running. We made a fortune, just made a fortune. The point being, if you take Aristophanes, and by the way, he was very conservative, there are a lot of really touchy sex jokes in his plays because they talk that way. But they're not vile, okay, but they're there. But he was a conservative in that he thought Athens was falling apart and was sick of it. and wrote these plays saying to Athens, shape up, you're falling apart, look what you're losing. And he would do it by having these wild inventions. He has a play called The Wasps about the jury system. He was livid because at that point in Athens, they were paying people to serve on juries. He thought, it's your civic duty. You have to, what, paying to go to a jury? So he writes this play called The Wasps, in which a smart, liberal young son is embarrassed because his father wants to serve on juries. His father loves serving on juries. His father thinks it's his civic duty, and the young man is so ashamed, he locks his father in the house, forbids him to go serve on the juries. Well, the father is riding out under a mule out the back door. He's pretending to be smoke and going up the chimney, and the son is being driven crazy, so he finally decides what he will do. He has to have a trial in the house. Keep his father at home, and his father will be the one juror who decides, and they put the dog on trial for stealing the cheese out of the kitchen. So you've got this dog there in the defendant's box, and there's this insane scene where all the kitchen utensils come and take the stand to testify against the dog. The cheese grater appears and gives testimony against it. It's just wild. It's wonderful. I love Aristophanes. So there was a great blossoming of Greek comedy as a result. Although Aristophanes couldn't write a tragedy, he never wrote a tragedy. But by the end he became so bitter and so angry. And it's true, the Peloponnesian Wars, Athens was done. Aristophanes was right. It was gone. The glory days were gone. They lasted for a while and then vanished. Because all things in this world fail. All things in this world fail. God never fails. Yes. Thank you again. Thank you very much. By the way, come up and take a look at these photos. They're very interesting.